politics without the soap opera, with unfiltered constitutional conservative truth. The Conservative Review with Daniel Horowitz.
And welcome back, fellow American patriots and Minutemen, standing at the ready to fight anew our life, liberty, and property, just like the Minutemen of yesteryear. Or is it just like that? This is your host, Daniel Horowitz, back here today for Thursday, March 14th, and trying to figure out, are we fighting for our lives or are we not? You know, I'm sure glad back during the Revolutionary War, we didn't have social media and grifting. Oh, the redcoats are coming. The redcoats are coming. Oh, whoops, sorry. I gotta grift a little bit. I gotta have some clicks and earn some fame, take some selfies. Like, when you're fighting, you actually have to be fighting where your input is geared towards an outcome. But instead, we have a grift core that taps into roughly all the things everyone's upset about, which is pretty much a lot. Invasion, inflation, inquisition, injections, indoctrination, Islamization, touches on every core of the fabric of social values, demographics, society, safety, health, budget, economy, and then the persecution. It's all on the line. We have a whole movement claiming to recognize it, but they just use it enough to joust with the left and the media on the memes. But then when it boils down to it, on every one of those things, the other side is winning, the pain is getting worse, and there's no savior on the horizon. There's no strategy to even do anything about it. As I've said, the conservative movement fights in the abstract while ignoring the tangible. There's no follow-through or continuity of strategy. Social media has killed our movement. Whatever happened to Shelby Park? Remember that whole fight with Greg Abbott and the feds? And it turned out that we had record numbers for February. You know, February always dips a little bit, but it was record. And now the Supreme Court extended the injunction on SB4, their interior enforcement bill. So we have a crisis of judicial supremacism, even the few cases where we get a good bill past the states. We have knotty issues like the weaponization problem, the persecution, state sovereignty, intractable debt crisis. That's not just a future solvency issue, as we talked about yesterday, but it's a here and now issue on inflation. PPI numbers are up now. Retail sales are down. Consumers tapped out. Inflation is off to the races again. And yet we don't have answers. We don't have answers. Oh, maybe next year we'll get in really good Republicans. No, just this week, we renominated Roger Wicker, one of the most liberal senators from one of the most conservative states, to another 6 years. We're stuck with him. And outside of a few cases in the margins, there's no real opportunities. I pushed for years to transform primaries into state conventions. We have no movement behind anything. If you don't like my ideas, what are your ideas? Or is this just the idea in and of itself? Commentating and memeing on other people's memes day to day, hour to hour, with no continuity of agenda. Let's follow up on all this border stuff. What are we doing about it? There is a House budget bill, believe it or not. And there's zero focus on that. Zero focus on states needing to pass other interior enforcement bills. Nothing. And it's all because we have a movement that is utterly paralyzed by one man and can't see beyond that. It's so weird. Jeremiah 17:5. Cursed is the one who trusts in man, who draws strength from mere flesh, and whose heart turns away from the Lord. The person will be like a bush in the wasteland. They will not see prosperity when it comes. See, every day you're supposed to wake up and try to get on God's side. And that's a hard thing. I mean, you know, it's something we all have to grow in. And we all make mistakes and it's not easy to ascertain. But at least there should be a veneer of, what does God want from me? I'm going to give judgment before him. This world is really temporary. The next world is the main thing. Standing between those two worlds is that judgment day. And, you know, I got a lot of problems. I got a lot of evil inclination working on me. But I'm at least going to try to ascertain a godly intent. No, every day they wake up and it's like, what does the Trump grift world want from me? So it's we have this weird dichotomy. I look at colleagues, friends, former friends, and they've never been this giddy. They're like really happy. They're enjoying themselves. Oh, we own the media here. I looked at this case. There's an NBC article that cites Elon Musk and right-wing influencers, you know, saying things about cannibals from Haiti. And they're sitting and saying, oh, we debunked NBC. Ha ha, we're owning them. Like, you might be owning them over the cannibals, but the laugh's on you because the cannibals are coming in. And Trinder Aragua is coming in. And we have no strategy on the horizon or even focus on the few leverage points we have to affect that. So the pain continues. They keep doing what they're doing. Nothing changes. The analogy I would give for where we are right now is kind of like someone gets into a car accident and they're just broken. They're lying there on the pavement off the side of the highway. Every limb is broken, got internal bleeding, organ damage. And it's like, you know, nowadays, of all the bad things in medicine, which there's many, trauma care has really improved. And that's part of what has led to, what has cushioned the decline in life expectancy from being even worse. But anyway, you know, it's the type of thing, you're really messed up, but maybe, you know, we get you flown to a trauma center, we could work on you and start, you know, save you and then start your long road to recovery. Maybe you won't be quite the same, but you'll live. So you're lying out there on the floor and then you see the paramedics come in the helicopter. And as much as you could have any thought of feeling through that pain, you have the sense of elation and relief. But then time goes on and they don't really come to you. They're kind of dancing around, schmoozing, drinking some coffee together, taking some selfies in front of the wrecked cars. And like, when are they coming? When are they coming? And then you finally realize they're not coming. And they might be enjoying themselves and they might be present there, but your pain is getting worse. Your internal bleeding is exacerbating by the moment, and then, you know, you're dead. So it does nothing good for me, the fact that you have, you know, a movement grifting, taking pictures of it, chronicling it, exposing it, talking about it, but then doing nothing to actually do anything and covering for the very elements that subvert it. This is the weirdest thing. I could understand if they did everything they did, but they were like balls to the wall with primaries. But no, they don't exist. And they haven't existed, frankly, since 2016. So what is the hope to change anything? Even if you're giddy about, oh, they're going to win the election, which is very much in doubt. But let's say you are. What exactly is going to change? Trump just said, floated the name, according to Bloomberg, Jeff Yass, as his Treasury Secretary. This is the guy that's a pimp for China and TikTok. And I know there's some disagreement. Some have, you know, questions on the language of the TikTok ban. They're concerned about it could be weaponized against us. There's what to say about that and different arguments and maybe the way you draft the bill. But just so you know, outside of the legacy sort of libertarians that have reasons to oppose it, that's not where the bulk of the opposition is coming from. And it's coming from people like Jeff Yass. And it's those sort of China cronies that are going to be his picks for Treasury Secretary. So I just want to go through different some of these issues, how they're getting worse. The more you think you expose them and own the lib media on how absurd and destructive and demonic these left-wing policies are, but nonetheless, they continue because we never follow up and follow through with them with the few leverage points that we have to actually do anything about it. Because my colleagues don't feel a sense of urgency to do anything. So I want to start off first with immigration, and then we'll go to weaponization, which we've forgotten all about. The weaponization they already funded, DHS they plan to fund next week without anything in return. But first, I just want to direct you, speaking of the border, you know, we talked about how the Blaze were going to be putting out special deep dives. So we have our next one on the border, how the elites use the border crisis against us. Following up on our expose on Colony Ridge, go to realbordercrisis.com, use promo code BORDER to get $30 off your Blaze TV Plus subscription. So that way you get, you know, Steve Dace for the entire year. You get all the content. My articles, certainly, and then this special, but all the specials. So it's a great deal because that's going to knock you under $100 for the entire year. Use promo code BORDER at therealbordercrisis.com. So, folks, yeah, I mean, this is getting bad. I mean, what's worse than Trinidad-Aragua? I guess Haitian cannibals. Just know that the Biden administration has already flown in 133,000 Haitians, according to Todd Benzman's documents he got at CIS. Our friends over there, 133,000 of these hyenas. You couldn't possibly find worse places in the world to bring in these people. And interestingly enough, aside from the cannibals and the gangs and the, you know, subversive culture, you know, the media is trying to say, oh, people aren't getting vaccinated enough, so there's measles outbreaks, but they never actually tell you the vaccination history of these people. So there were 7 cases of measles, according to CDC, at a Chicago migrant shelter. So it's funny, the thought crossed my mind, as we've well learned, what we've learned the last 4 years is that with most illnesses, vaccination is not what drives the rise and flow of it. It's the standard of living, sanitation. That's really what changed. So we've gotten rid of a lot of this stuff, you know, because we have a higher standard of living. Other places like Haiti and Venezuela and God knows where else in you know, all over Africa, they have it because, some of it our government created, but other things are due to just hygiene and sanitation, things like that. So you bring that in large numbers, well, you're going to bring it in. So we are told that states have the police power to have travel bans on other Americans, to lock down businesses, churches, your movements, restrict your breathing, and restrict your ability to access public accommodation if you don't get a jab that was never proven to work and then eventually proven to not work and have negative efficacy. But you could bring, but states don't have the police power to have a travel ban and block people coming in from places that we know are, you know, more prone to have these diseases. So whatever happened to public health emergency? Remember, and we're coming up on, you know, tomorrow or over the weekend, really, is the 4th anniversary of the Fourth Reich, March 16th, 15 days to flatten the curve. And remember how it was like there was no backstop. A state, forget about a state, some sort of county garbage collector was able to call a 7 p.m. press conference. Here's what we're doing. You know, here's how you're allowed to breathe, where you can move, how you can walk, where you could drive. And it was all good. Public health. But you can't keep out foreign invaders. And the Supreme Court is screwing with SB4. Again, we have real questions. We need solutions. And again, you have no idea the transformation that we haven't fully realized and sensed from this wave. Because if you just look at previous waves, I saw a story online about a street in Columbus, Ohio, now named for Muhammad Abdullah Hassan. He was a Somalian leader who waged jihad against Italy and Great Britain in 1899, resulting in 200,000 dead people. And he was really the icon of Al-Shabaab. But now we have the second largest Somali community outside of Minneapolis, Cedar River community there, is in a community in Columbus, Ohio, and they now have state reps, Representative Ismail Muhammad. He's behind it. Remember, this has been building for two to three decades, and now they're reaching critical mass with political clout, with being very bold and brazen. This is Ohio. You know, I could move on to Tennessee. There's an article out recently that Congo and Sudan are the two largest sources of refugees. Congo and Sudan. Speaking of cannibals, you got a lot of that going on in Congo, a lot of these countries. That's what we're bringing in. Where is this? From the Tennessee Star. Now, this is mainly from refugees, which, by the way, Governor Bill Lee embraced. And by the way, I want to revisit this, because this is a perfect example of Jeremiah 17:5, when you're so up a man's rear end rather than doing Micah 6:8 and doing justice, doing what's right, walking discreetly with God, you can't even actualize the benefits of your idol. So one of the good things we got, I wrote in my original book, Stolen Sovereignty, and we successfully got Trump to adopt this, was to ban refugee resettlement unless states opt in. So it's not even like you have to opt out. You have to opt into it. And what happened was, because we were so distracted and didn't have a ground game to work the red states, we couldn't even benefit from Trump's gift. So the left immediately, all their NGOs worked all the red states, and almost every single governor, not DeSantis and one or two others, but and Greg Abbott, to his credit, did actually opt out. But Bill Lee and Kristi Noem and all these people, DeWine certainly in Ohio. So Tennessee has become a cesspool for third world and Muslim immigration. The second highest number of refugees by country of origin comes from Venezuela. Third is Burma. And fourth is Afghanistan. Other notable countries include Syria, Sudan, Colombia, Guatemala. Real nice. Real, real nice. So that's what we got there in Tennessee. You can't recover from this. An interesting thing. There's this poll out. Saw this on Twitter somewhere. That 71% of Jewish teens in America have experienced anti-Semitic harassment or discrimination. 61% experience bias in person, 46% online. And the point was that it's more younger than older. And of course, it's lost to the authors of the article what's going on there. Now, even before we get to foreigners, obviously young people are more demonic, even if they're American, as we see that, and they're unmoored from any sense of tradition, history, and certainly godly values. But the bigger thing is, we've talked about this before, you look at immigration numbers, like, you know, for example, basically, what are we at now? 16% of the country is foreign born, but then it's closer to a quarter are foreign born or children of foreign born. But that's the aggregate. If you would divide it by generation, it's all weighted younger. In other words, you know, among those 70 and older, it would be much less. So if you're a, you know, 15 to 25-year-old American teen who's Jewish, well, for the most part, who are you going to be interacting with? People of the same age? Well, that's disproportionately saturated with people that come from cannibal land that subscribe to every pre-Enlightenment sort of mentality, and one of them is the Jews drink the blood and kill people and control the world and that sort of bullcrap that we kind of got rid of in the Enlightenment and, you know, didn't have, you know, in large part in America, and now we brought that back. So it's lost on all these people. For, you know, I saw Kristi Noem was all proud of herself, doesn't pass a single bill of consequence in the entire legislative session except for the bill she endorsed to grab land for a green energy pipeline. But then she was all proud she had some sort of anti-Semitism bill. Now, I didn't know how much of how much of an issue that is in South Dakota. But to the extent it is, it's because she brought in refugees from places that would do that. It's not going to come from the native population there. Very much not. You know, they kind of have the old Americans from the upper Midwest were sort of the Minnesota nice. They don't really do that. To the extent that there's any part of the country that would buy into it, certainly wouldn't be that part of the country. But you brought it in. So what is our answer? If we don't shut this down, we won't have a corner of a red state that's not saturated with this craziness. Don't think Colony Ridge in Liberty County, Texas, is the only example of them colonizing rural areas, which increasingly is the only place we could go and retreat to. But we just continue. We just meme. Oh, look at the media. Ha ha, we expose them on this. You expose anything. Biden is opening up new fronts. The CIA probably was involved in that coup in Haiti. So just so they can go and destabilize it, bring in more people from there. Where is the push to get the states to actually enforce and to deal with judicial supremacism and to have a budget fight over it? Where's the focus on the budget? Nothing. I don't get it. We literally have the DHS funding bill. This is it. This is the end of the road. It's been a long process. This was always the biggest leverage point when they took over the House. And we're now, you know, what is it? 14 months into this. And this is the end. This is the end. This is the final opportunity. You pass that DHS funding bill. And really, the rest of the government, it's not like they're holding up anything else as leverage. They passed the NDAA, they passed the Pfizer reauthorization. So there's nothing left. So this man has a free lane. There is quite literally nothing. He could literally announce, I'm letting in cannibals. And you won't have state enforcement. You won't have a budget fight. And we'll be reporting. You'll have all these memes online. Oh, the cannibals. But then it's not like we'll pressure the people to do anything. Like, hey, well, who's in charge of the party? Meta Trump. Well, shouldn't we get Meta Trump to go ahead and give Johnson a kick in the rear end? But no, instead he's giving our guys the kick in the rear end in the primaries. So nothing matters. By the way, on the budget, I want you guys to understand the contrast between the parties, between the respective industries and movements, what a movement looks like. So they're starting to craft the rest of the bills. It includes everything. Not everything. We already funded DOJ. But it includes things like DOD, DHS, labor, HHS. And one of them is state foreign ops. So basically State Department and all foreign operations. So the only kink right now, sort of in the negotiations between Johnson and the White House and Chuck Schumer, it's not over, we will not fund the government until states have the right to shut down the invasion. And we shut it down at the border. It's that the Democrats are now holding up the state foreign ops bill because they are demanding massive arming of Hamas. I'm not kidding you. Schmuck Schumer, who claims to be Jewish, but is more like the mixed multitudes that Moses mistakenly brought out from Egypt that subverted the nation. He's probably an incarnation of it. Disgusting human being. He's fighting for jihad. It's like, could you imagine like a Jewish Senate majority leader in 1941 demanding we aid the SS? Like, and I'm going to shut down the government for it. But nonetheless, these guys are willing to engage in brigmanship and potentially cause a government shutdown over funding Hamas and a color revolution in Israel. So they're funding Hamas. And then Schumer said today, they're doing this privately and they have been doing it for 2 years, but he openly called for an overthrow of Netanyahu, openly to install a left-wing government. See, the Republicans have made it so easy to take over America. Now Biden's kind of getting bored, so he's taking his show on the road and doing it to Israel and trying to install a left-wing government that, you know, to work with Hamas. And he's funding Hamas. I'm not kidding you. Folks, that's what a movement looks like. We're going to shut down the government in order to fund Hamas. These guys are awesome. I love them. And yet Republicans, when we freaking have like the most violent gangs and cannibals and there's another child sex offender in Maryland arrested today. I mean, there's an endless supply of them, and they won't have a government shutdown fight over that. And we all think we're winning. And there are things we could have been doing. We've squandered. There still are a few things left. And there's no focus. It's just, let me make my monthly pilgrimage to Mar-a-Lago and take a selfie there and, you know, have my memes and, you know, make sure I go online and tiptoe around Trump and, you know, focus on transgenderism. But then when we have the biggest form of grooming with it, which is Bruce Jenner, somehow I'm like deadly silent. Like, I got a question for you guys. There's two big influencers online that are trying to normalize the fact that a guy sitting there with a penis could be a woman. There's Dylan Mulvaney and there's Bruce Jenner. So they're all, you know, because Mulvaney keeps putting out these videos or whatever. So they're all into that. But, you know, riddle me here, right? You know, answer this riddle for me here. Who is a bigger threat? Dylan Mulvaney, who's influencing really left-wing, or Bruce Jenner, who's not just influencing Republicans, but the Trump right, the hard right, supposedly hard right, that's based, right? I mean, you would say that's a much bigger threat because you're normalizing that behavior even on the right. That's number one. And number two is, which one is more redressable? That you, if you would create a firestorm, you're going to stop. Dylan Mulvaney or Bruce Jenner? Well, you'd say, well, obviously Bruce Jenner, because he's hanging out in Mar-a-Lago. I mean, while you're making your pilgrimages to Mar-a-Lago, tweeting things about Dylan Mulvaney, maybe you ought to say hello to Bruce down there using the female bathroom and say, hey, cut the crap out. And he's literally out there every second saying, you know, we can't have men and female sports, but make no mistake, gender is, you know, fluidity is real and men are women. I mean, I don't get it. 100% of the time is spent influencing what you can't influence and then tiptoeing around and avoiding what you can. And it's interesting, there's also this whole cadre now. Let's say we need a 10 in this country, and DeSantis delivers a 9, and Trump and all of his supporters like Ms. McMaster and Abbott and Kristi Noem and all these people, they deliver a negative 10. So they'll all be over DeSantis every second, either lying about him or saying he didn't do enough. But then it's like, all right, well, you know, I'm all for a movement to pressure him to get even more righteous. That's great. But then by a factor of a million, you'll be all over these other guys, right? Like, I literally saw someone saying, oh, DeSantis' office didn't get back to me on our, you know, our colleague Steve Baker when he was arrested. And indeed, DeSantis actually put out a statement online. And I texted a friend of mine who was kind of into this. I said, hey, did you reach out to Greg Abbott? Because he's from Texas, right? This happened in Dallas, which is our headquarters. And the answer I got was, well, this is federal. He had nothing to do with it. Well, this is all federal, but everyone's blaming DeSantis for not speaking up enough about Floridians being arrested. Well, it's kind of the same thing. It's a little bit bizarre what's going on with that, by the way. A little bit bizarre. I'm all for being equal opportunity, pressuring everyone, every red state, and that's what we should be doing. But it's like he could do no right, and no other Republican could do any wrong. There's something very dark and demonic about where that's coming from and where that's headed. But anyway, that's the first half. So on immigration, we're just still, you know, we think we want it because we have our online memes and it's worse than ever. But then there's the other half, weaponization, and that's where I want to get to our special guest. So the second half of today's show is really a mirror image of the first half, because the border and the weaponization persecution issues are two peas in a pod. It's the same thing. They're existential. We can't live unless these things are redressed. We don't have a society, we don't have security, or we don't have freedom in the case of the latter. And they're all similar in that we all agree it's existential, it's a problem, we use existential language, all of us. It's got to be dealt with. And we meme, and we have our stories, and we have our podcasts, and we make our money. But then in the way it matters at the time it matters, okay, just like we're talking about on the border, there's a federal leverage with the budget, and then there's all things we can do in the states. There's nothing. So it's the same thing with the persecution. Like, this is not funny. A colleague of mine was arrested for reporting things our government didn't like. I mean, this is the nightmare scenario. So I can meme about it, but what are we going to do about it? And as you well know, we had really three tools. So there are things the states could do. It's not, I would argue it's not as foolproof, at least in the legal structure we live in, as demagnetizing with, you know, illegal immigration, but there's stuff we could be doing. And then there's the hearings, which went nowhere. Remember that weaponization committee? Whatever happened to it? And then there's the budget. Oh, whoops. How come nobody ever mentioned that for the remainder of his presidency, DOJ is now fully funded? Jack Smith's prosecution is fully funded. The prosecutions against all political opponents are fully funded. No riders, no policy changes. Oh, and actually, it's even worse than that. Because we had one other leverage point on this issue, which was the FISA reauthorization. And even more so than on immigration, you actually did have a bipartisan bill in House Judiciary with Jerry Nadler on board for their own purposes, you know, because I guess the, you know, Hamas dudes don't, you know, want these tools to ever be used against them. So, you know, we had some bipartisan support behind it, and Johnson just totally gives it away for free, tacks it onto an already bad NDAA, which sells out the military for free, along with selling out the budget for free. And this is all with Trump support. I'm sorry. But, I mean, there's not a word. He's not even calling on these tools to be used even for his own issues with his own skin in the game. I don't get it. So here we go on, and a year and a half later, after this election over weaponization, we're nowhere. It's worse than it ever is. And what is our answer? And that leads into our next guest, my good friend, Steve Friend, who gave it all, gave up his career to leave the FBI and become an FBI whistleblower, thinking that he'll help lead a movement. Now, I'm bringing him in almost as a double entendre of the theme of the show, not just because to show, you know, how we have important issues that we don't redress, we don't do anything about it, but also that it's being led by memers and influencers that get sucked into this vortex of nothingness, which is why we never do anything about issues. But he is the one different guy I've ever seen. There's a lot of people like Steve Friend that they'll have some sort of moment, some sort of, they'll come out from an industry or, you know, dissenting from something, or they'll get the video posted. They'll have a moment in the news. And what happens with these people is every one of them I've noticed, they get sucked into the industry. And you almost can't blame them. That's all you have. So they get invited down to Mar-a-Lago. They get some sort of, you know, job where they make a lot of money, and they do absolutely nothing. Steve is very important, not just because what he has to say, but what he represents. And I really mean this, because Steve, we've talked about this before, when you're kind of middle age, cut your career short in the FBI, and you have a family, there's not many places you can go in law enforcement thereafter to earn a decent living. So the only thing you can do is become a hero on the right industry and grift away. But he actually sacrificed himself, not to grift, but because he believed, I'm part of an FBI. That, like, this is not funny. This is North Korea. They're really coming after political opponents. This really is not funny. So he goes to House Judiciary, whistleblower. They just take his testimony, do nothing with it. He's like, I've had it. And rather than being part of the grift, he does what we do here, doesn't earn a lot of money, but spends time working on policy. He's a fellow on domestic intelligence and security services at Center for Renewing America. We have a lot of friends there. We just had one of his colleagues, Wade Miller, on last week. And he's actually writing legislation and ideas for how we want to connect what we all universally say is a problem to actually do something about it. And I want to promote this bill and some other ideas here today. You can follow him at Real Steve Friend on Twitter. Make sure to pick up his book, True Blue, because it's not a grifting book. It actually is a blueprint of what we need more in terms of whistleblowers, but you're not going to get more whistleblowers if they're going to sacrifice their career and get no policy in return other than grift. Well, maybe you will if you get the grift, but you get my drift here. Hey, Steve, welcome again. Hey. It's been way too long. First off, Steve, before we delve into it, you have a new podcast. Could you tell people how to find it?
Yeah, thank you for that. It's called True Blue, the same as my book. It's on Patriot TV, and it streams there every day, 3 Eastern time for 30 minutes. And then the audio format we actually house under the existing podcast that I have over on Rumble, which is called the American Radicals Podcast, which I do with another whistleblower on Saturdays. So all the audio is housed in one under one umbrella, but Patriot.TV, and you can get True Blue every weekday, 3:00.
Patriot.TV, True Blue. And this really is True Blue. When we say back the blue, it means, you know, being fully against evil, crime, anarchy, but just as vociferously against tyranny, including when law enforcement is marshaled into it. So Steve, what am I missing? So, like, look, I was very into the vaccines, but I knew that wasn't sexy. And the COVID, I knew, like, we were done. We weren't going to redress that in the HHS budget bill. And we're just, you know, that's just not cool. But I thought we're all into weaponization, especially because the real, poster child is, you know, the chosen one. I mean, you know, obviously that's what I thought all cared about, right? We don't, in other words, if we don't care about the issue, we certainly care about Trump, right? So could you explain to me the psychology of how last week we just funded DOJ for free for the remainder of the term? I mean, technically it's till October 1st, but you know what that means, the remainder of the term, because they're not going to have a funding fight then, right before the election. So it's not news. Like, I'm the only one talking about it. What's up with that?
There's a fundamental problem, I think, in the DNA, the conservative right, where their default option is we have to back the blue, whatever the cost. And we immediately assume that no matter what the agency is doing, it's objectively a good thing. There's no way that they're going to be off the rails. And that's just irresponsible on our part. I think it's just short-sighted. So I think that that is a problem and a hurdle that has to be overcome when you're looking at funding in FBI, which objectively you can see what's going on. And then you really just have to put it into the most extreme, absurd terms possible. And you have to ask the representatives what level of weaponization, be it against Donald Trump or Mark Hauk in Philadelphia or Paul Vaughn in Tennessee, what level of weaponization are you willing to tolerate in order to go back to your constituents and say that I back the blue? And I think that that's a question that has never been posed in that way to them. And as a result of that, they just continue to just default to giving them all the funds that they need. And I think secondly, they just don't understand the fact that the FBI at this point is widely and broadly interpreting its mandate when it comes to national security. And that's evolved into domestic terrorism. And they have rewritten the way that they're going to interpret that to give themselves work to do. And then there's the political angle where they go after people with problematic political beliefs, wrong think in their view. And that's how you get something like a term of anti-government, anti-authority, violent extremists, which according to the FBI and Department of Homeland Security, who have authored a strategic intelligence assessment on this, the profile of an anti-government, anti-authority, violent extremist is someone who just has a perception of government overreach or negligence.
So that's very important that you're saying this is codified in their policy that anyone who opposes government overreach, that is a domestic terrorist. So we literally passed a budget bill without redressing that. And that's unbelievable. I simply don't get it. Whatever happened to the weaponization committee?
That's a good question. I mean, I've been asked before about what my opinion is on them, and I will wait to render judgment until they actually do something. It seems to be, to me, just interested in having some hearings, which is the Broadway show. I understand that there's a purpose for that, and to me, the purpose of a hearing is to have the show for the American people. None of the information that I presented to Congress was new to them on May 18th of last year when I testified. I'd done that several months earlier in a behind closed door deposition. That was the opportunity to go on national television and tell the American people the problems that exist and then hopefully galvanize a grassroots or at least an appetite for reforms and make recommendations. But to me, it just seems like it's claptrap for getting on cable news at night, getting a viral moment for your fundraising or for your campaign for the next go around. And that's it, which is incredibly disappointing. It's an enormously lost opportunity, especially when it comes to someone like myself or Garrett O'Boyle, who testified with me, because we're experienced in testimony. That sort of room was not something that intimidated us like it would the lay person. And we were there. We were loaded for bear, just like the IRS guys. Those guys had laptops. They were ready to present. But instead, it was just a back and forth between the elected officials who were trying to get on camera for their viral moment to get on TV that night.
It's so sad. Again, it's like a car wreck. And rather than resuscitating the patient, you're just sitting and taking selfies in front of the wrecked cars. And that's an end to itself. So we're basically screwed. You know, the FISA leverage is given away. The budget leverage is given away. So as always, we got to turn to, well, where do we have alleged power and influence that's in the red states? Obviously, this is a little bit harder because, you know, federal law enforcement is tougher to block than illegal aliens. So you have an important piece of legislation in Tennessee right now that I want everyone to write down. I want to be able to introduce this in every state we can, get it passed, not this session, certainly next session, to be ready from day one to have this as one of our top priorities. Describe your bill number, who's introducing it, and what it does.
Yeah, the bill sponsor, it's Representative Todd Warner and Senator Joey Hensley. And we have some official co-sponsors, Jody Barrett and Brian Ritchie. And essentially, this is an amendment to a bill that will prohibit state-certified law enforcement officers, so anybody who is a certified peace officer in the state of Tennessee, from participating in an FBI joint terrorism task force. It does not preclude them from sharing information with the FBI one way or another, using fusion centers, which are actually a Homeland Security invention when it comes to national security. It doesn't stop them from working on criminal investigations, violent crime, drugs, gangs, anything of that sort. And there are task forces that do that. Essentially, it says you cannot be on a joint terrorism task force. And the reasons for that are as follows. if you are on a JTTF, you have to have a security clearance. And as a result of that, if you're a deputy, the FBI will give you assignments and you cannot tell your sheriff what you're working on. So you've essentially disempowered the chief law enforcement executive for a particular municipality or a county, which is not what we want to have. And the fact that the FBI has broadly interpreted its national security mandate and is demonstrating itself to be directly targeting people for wrong think and in violating its caveat that it does not investigate First Amendment protected activity, which it does. You know, if you are a regular attendee at a Christian church, the FBI will say, well, we don't investigate you for that, but you could be a Christian nationalist and that's tied to white supremacy and that's racially motivated violent extremism. Ergo, we will open an assessment and eventually investigate you for that. So that's the logic behind it. And I think being on the inside and knowing the dirty truth about the FBI is that they don't have the staffing and the personnel to actually do all the work that they have in their quota systems to do and to achieve. I can speak firsthand. In Daytona, we had two people, myself included, on the JTTF who were actually FBI employees. So we were heavily reliant on local authorities and local agencies to give us personnel and to give us resources and to give us intel. And if you are to harden your area, harden your state, you can kind of bring the FBI back into line to go after the real bad guys, the real crime that we sort of expect them to do, and actually go after real threats to national security as opposed to reinterpreting what your mandate is on national security to go after your perceived political enemies.
So a couple things here. Let me just try to play this out here. So this bill's in Tennessee. So let's say you have kind of a conservative part of the state and the feds come in and say, through their, you know, FBI field office in Nashville or wherever else, hey, you know, Davidson County here. Well, maybe it wouldn't be Davidson, but maybe Williams County or a little bit around there, farther out where it's more conservative. And they say, we feel that in a lot of these churches or there's organizations where you have militia and they're right wingers that are anti-government and we need to start investigating that. So they call the local sheriff's department and want to rope them in. So you're saying this bill would prevent them from doing what?
It would prevent them from taking personnel in the form of, they call them a task force officer. So you would be nominated from your agency to go work for the FBI. You get federal deputization. So you have federal arrest authority in conjunction with your state arrest authority and you work together. And it's multiple agencies that work on a task force to address whatever the task at hand is. It could be gangs, it could be drugs. In this case, it is terrorism, where that's why it's called a joint terrorism task force. But the FBI gets to pick the cases it wants to work. I mean, and as a result of that, I can tell you that almost all the cases that we had in my office were domestic terrorism, and they were January 6th related, which is what the FBI said is its biggest and largest and most important case, even though those cases are actually mostly criminal cases, they're being labeled as terrorism cases so that they can be handed over to a JTTF. I think it's also important to note that if there is a legitimate national security threat, there's nothing stopping a local agency from sharing that information, from doing its own investigation, from even working with another agency like Homeland Security. This is directly targeted at the FBI-sponsored and organized Joint Terrorism Task Force to send a shot across the bow that we want to bring them back into alignment. You can't just broadly interpret what terrorism is and say that that is someone who has a social media account where they say that I think it's wrong to mask to go on an airplane, because that's government overreach. And now they are in the crosshairs of an anti-government, anti-authority, violent extremist investigation on behalf of the FBI.
So what would you say, you get this bill to committee in Tennessee and other states, and then the committee chairman tells you, well, you know, I sympathize with your concern about the FBI, but at the end of the day, we do have a lot of, you know, Hamas bros and Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda and these other guys. And is the bill written too broad that, look, you know, you can't sit on a joint terrorism task force? Well, you know, shouldn't we maybe just narrowly define it to domestic or for specific categories of political groups in terms of the prohibition rather than all terrorism? In other words, wouldn't they be concerned that that would preclude them from being deputized to work against, you know, foreign terrorism?
I think they might get wrapped around the axle on terminology, but I think the lesson that we have to learn here is that the left just reinterprets words. They don't change the law. They just change the way that they understand words. So any sort of hemming and hawing about what the term is and how we can sort of tailor it to go after particular groups, that will just be reinterpreted to go after the political enemies that the FBI wants to. And they're going to do it under the radar because they have this national security clearance. And ergo, someone who's a local officer can't go back to his boss, or it's going to be all the pressure is going to be on him to step away and come out, and it will have violated his security clearance if he does that. So there's a lot of pressure. And to me, though, it's the ultimate hurdle, which we're getting a lot of pushback from, and even from some of the law enforcement unions, is the financial hurdle, because the FBI essentially gets these agencies in with golden handcuffs, and they say, if you give us your personnel in the form of task force officers, we will give you overtime. We will pay all of your agencies overtime for those people who get worked quite a bit. And that's a lot of money that a sheriff or police chief has to be willing to give up and forego. But ultimately, the question comes down to how much weaponization are you willing to allow to be put upon your citizens in return for free overtime? And if you're in a position of public trust, the answer should always be none.
And that's always the old problem as to why we cannot maintain sovereignty and independence on moral and just governance in red states, simply because they feel so desperate for cash. And the feds come in and they print the money, go into debt, and then incentivize everyone to do their bidding. So that is, yeah, that definitely is going to be a challenge, the money. But also, just in terms of the policy, I want to make sure I have your idea correct. What you're trying to do is saying, look, we all say we trust local law enforcement better than the FBI. We certainly don't trust the FBI anymore. So what your bill, and I want to make sure people understand this, what it will do is put the state in the driver's seat. So it's not that, like, so we're the ones that will determine what is a threat based on what we see. If we're like, hey, we have a bunch of Al-Shabaab dudes around here that we think are a problem, they could certainly call up the FBI. It's that they can't be deputized as an official member of the Joint Terrorism Task Force, so that then they'll be sworn to secrecy through a clearance that the elected sheriff will not be. So A, they could potentially be marshaled into bad behavior, bad investigations that violate civil liberties, but then also the elected sheriff will be in the dark. Is that the goal of your bill?
It is, and I think it's also worth noting that state-certified law enforcement officers are not trained on national security. I was state-certified in the state of Georgia, and I was trained on criminal code for the state of Georgia, as is the case with anybody in Tennessee. So their expertise and their experience is strictly based in criminal activity, and that's why it specifically spells out in this bill, which is it's Senate Bill number 2804 and House Bill number 2912, because it's got co-sponsors in both houses. This says that those officers can continue to work on task forces with the FBI on matters that pertain to Title 18, Title 21, which are criminal and drug-related crimes. So we want to address what those guys actually have the experience and expertise in, and not let them be deputized under the umbrella of national security, which they're not really trained for.
You're saying you're targeted what A, they're not trained for anyway, and B, the titles that are being used to rope in under their umbrella all these things, the pro-life activists, religious people, political opponents, anti-government opponents, sort of things like that. You're saying, for example, drug task forces have nothing to do with that. I mean, at least not yet. They haven't found a way to do that. So again, this is SB 2804, and what's the House bill?
2912.
So folks, definitely look that up and get a copy around to other states where you are. Let's get this introduced, again, along with our kind of nullification bills, our illegal immigration enforcement bills, our currency bills. These are the sorts of force multipliers that are going to create constitutional sanctuaries. And with the feds doing what they're doing, I mean, the GOP Congress at the federal level, this is really the only thing we can do, is to gradually fight in the states. I would also argue that we do need a bill allowing for the state attorney general to fund the legal defense of someone that they believe is politically targeted. I think that's really important as well. Just so you have, you know, they're being bankrupted. It's a financial issue. It's also, you know, they have trouble getting legal help often. So, you know, it's important that the state has your back. That in itself, even if they don't interpose, but they defend you, that in itself has value. Any other things that you're working on in this realm?
Yes. Well, last year I helped out in Collier County, Florida, pass a Bill of Rights Sanctuary County Ordinance. And that the language of that bill I'm trying to push out to as many county board of commissioners as I can. And that's based off of the coronavirus lockdowns that happened. And they got the assurances from a constitutional sheriff that he would stand in the gap. Nothing changes unless it changes. And if the federal government or even the state government comes in and says you have to shut down your non-essential business that you use to pay all your bills and feed your family, that the sheriff will stand in the gap and we're going to nullify that. And that's even at a more granular localized level, not even at the state house.
No, I mean, this is very good. That's where it needs to go. It ties into medical freedom, too. All these issues, whenever you have the feds violating civil liberties, I mean, this is where our founders envisioned having a layered government. So you wouldn't have a monopoly where you don't have anyone with a degree of power and influence that couldn't interpose on your behalf. And, you know, Federalist 46 spells this out pretty clearly. Steve, before I let you go, I just wanted to see if you want to comment on my brief or not so brief intro to you. I really just on a more rote political level, and I know your whole point is to actually talk about getting things done and not the politics, but do you see what I see, that most people that are embraced by the conservative industry, oh, we got a whistleblower, we got a guy that did something badass today, and within 3 seconds, they get marshaled into that grift of nothingness, a bridge to nowhere. You're the only one I'm seeing that's actually trying to look at where the playing field is, and it's not on Twitter. It's actually getting laws and policies changed. Is there a reason why you're such a rare breed?
Well, thanks for saying that. It's a real honor to hear that from you. I think that I've embraced the idea that being American isn't a leisure pursuit, and that's why I pursued a career in civic duty and then civil service. And I continue to embrace that idea. And because we're not a leisure pursuit, we are an action verb. We have to be willing to be uncomfortable and inconvenienced at time. And I'm still an American citizen. I'm not an FBI agent anymore, but that doesn't change the fact that I swore an oath, and my oath doesn't expire until I do. And I'm going to do whatever I can. I'm going to bring whatever resources, intellectually, experience that I can to bear to do what I thought to do. And that was to stand against a bullies. If the bully was a criminal when I was a police officer and FBI agent, then I investigated them and then brought them to justice. Now, clearly, the FBI has taken on that role, and I will stand in the gap there. And that's why I'll do whatever I can and in the most effective way that I possibly can. And I don't think that we have a savior in Washington, D.C. at this point. I think that that's been proven to be sort of the fool's errand to rely on them, which is why I'm going to rely on the doctrine of the lesser magistrate to be my prime directive and look to my state houses and fortify my community and my county.
No, absolutely. I mean, this is definitely something we want to do. I appreciate and applaud you for your work. Patriot.tv, the True Blue podcast. Make sure to listen to more pearls of wisdom, action items. And, you know, as we assemble our kitchen cabinet, Steve is going to be our director here of, you know, defending against persecution. So SB 2804, HB 2912, Tennessee. Make sure to put in 2024 session so you don't get a previous year's bill. So that will be your bill. Let me know your feedback, DanielHurwitz@startmail.com, because, you know, if you're meeting resistance and they try to question it, we're going to come back with Steve and we'll help you out and try to make this work and give you the best arguments so we can actually solve this problem, because we don't have time. We're out of time today as well. Thank you, Steve. Thank you all. God bless you all. Remember, folks, this is not a game. This is real. Jeremiah 17:15. 17:5. Until tomorrow, God bless you all. And thank you for listening.